Welcome to the Esports Business Network podcast. I am Trent Knox, the founder and CEO of Esports Business Network. I will be the host on this episode of the EBN podcast, EBNP number 55. Our guest is Ben Pfefferman, Chief Executive Officer of Amica Esports. In this podcast, we discuss Ben's motivation to start an esports company, how the company operates, and current events in the esports industry. Enjoy.
This is the future. Evolution. This is the future.
Welcome back to the Esports Business Network podcast. Today I'm joined with, what can I say, an incredibly talented entrepreneur, someone who's basically built it the back of Amica Esports and everything that's associated with it off of incredibly good networking skills and production skills and so many different skills. And I've been really looking forward to have him on the show. Welcome to the show, Ben Pfefferman.
Yeah, thanks so much for the kind words. And it's great to be here.
Yeah, we had like a call almost a month ago before to kind of just do a discovery call and talk about our two productions and what we're doing, our brands and stuff like that. And I had found out about your stuff, I think, on YouTube. I was doing a little bit of research and just typing esports podcasts and then sorting features, trying to find some stuff, and listen to your show and then. We connected on LinkedIn and had a conversation there. And from there, I knew that it would be awesome to collaborate and have a show. Before we get into like all of the esports stuff related to Amica Esports, I wanted to get for the audience to get to know you a little bit better and to understand like what was the mindset and the direction when it came to, you know, getting into the gaming and esports industry. So like, where did you grow up and what was like the gaming community, in over there?
Yeah, I grew up in Toronto. I've been here most of my life, except now, over the past 2 weeks, I've been, living in Boca Raton in Florida. My gaming journey, kind of like anyone else my age, like just a big gamer into all the big games growing up, but didn't really see anything beyond that as a profession, as a career. Probably circa, coming into 2015 is when I started investing in the esports industry. I had a bit of a finance background and, started to get involved there. I opened up my own investment bank, and that was when I started raising money for different tech companies and eventually esports companies. Did about three different raises for them. But then kind of saw what was happening was that there wasn't a lot of sort of diversification or synergy with some of the esports companies that were raising, and just really thought that there needed to be a company that had a whole ecosystem. And I kind of define that as, gaming arenas and tournament organizers and teams and media and content all rolled into one. And that was kind of, sort of the accidental start of Amica Esports, was saying, hey, I don't really want to be the CEO of an esports company, but there isn't really anyone else doing it. So I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and see how it goes. And it's been a great ride ever since.
Yeah. It's an industry that is obviously in the buzzword category. There are three buzzwords that really are going around as industries, and that's, cannabis, blockchain, and esports. Those three are just always up in conversation when someone's talking about entrepreneurship or starting a marketing company or doing design agency and stuff like that. And so you to jump into the industry is something that makes sense. And the timing is great with 2015 on the cusp of a Ninja Drake with Twitch streaming and really in 2015 when Twitch really kind of, well, I mean, to the end of 2014 with the conversations about acquisitions from Amazon, big purchasing and stuff like that. And so it's really interesting to hear that you had this perspective, because I didn't have that perspective until late 2017, 2018, where I went to the conventions and saw basically that on the operations side, people were, it just seemed like they weren't getting it the same way I was getting it. And so I'm sure that's sort of the perspective that you had when you looked at esports and gaming.
Yeah, I definitely would say by 2015, I was not a sophisticated esports investor. I didn't know the industry left and right. But I think with any, you know, any startup that you invest in my opinion, it doesn't really matter what the product or service is. If there's a good management team, and you know, I'm in. So it was more about investing in people, really, than it was the industry. But as I started to learn more and get involved, became a lot more strategic. And we as a company, we've made a bunch of investments in companies. We've acquired a whole bunch of companies. And I can see the industry and evaluate companies now through a different lens, you know, now sort of as an esports operator.
What was the process of setting up an investment bank? Because is there some sort of legal issues with esports right now because of the gambling aspect?
Yeah, so I had started a company called Amuga Capital first, and that was a registered investment bank, investment dealer, depending on what country you're in. Essentially, a securities regulator gives you the okay that you can take investments from investors and match them up with different companies, right? So that was the start of Amuga Capital. And then, you know, as we created our own esports company, maybe we were just lazy and not very creative, but we just used the same name, Amuga Esports, and called the esports company that. So yeah, one is the function that it's a bank and it raises capital, and Amuga Esports is an esports operating company that, you know, holds all the assets and makes its own acquisitions and investments.
Oh, so essentially they're separate companies.
Yeah.
Separate and whatnot. So, which is interesting. I have, you know, this is a separate question outside of the interview, but when it comes to special acquisition companies and stuff like that in this space, like how does it work? Because let's say you have your your investment bank, and you're looking to acquire, and with the special interest acquisition companies, you're not allowed to know what company you're going to invest in prior to going public. And so, are you familiar with this? Does this exist?
Yeah, sure. I can talk about I can talk about SPACs for the in the U.S. market, and I can talk a little bit about what we have in Canada. Because it makes kind of more companies, esports companies are going public through Canadian capital markets.
Right. Yeah.
For a whole bunch of reasons. But yeah, the SPAC essentially it's a blind pool. They raise money. It IPOs. Oh, that people can't see my quotations. It IPOs already. So it's trading on a stock exchange, and then they make an announcement of the asset that they bring in. There's been tons of SPACs. The last one I was in was SoFi, for example. So SoFi, the big fintech bank in the U.S. Mm-hmm. SPAC, and there's literally hundreds. So it's a great way for companies to go public. In Canada, it's a little bit different. You can know what the target is. You can raise money. In a shell, it's called a shell. You put money in, and then you can, you know, pick your target and whatnot.
Yeah. I appreciate you for explaining that, because it's been something that's you know, I think complicated for me to see, because I'm looking at it from a US marketplace where it's sort of supposed to be secret in a way. It's supposed to be like this, you don't know what you're doing with your money, but these, you know, people, well, you're obviously an investor when you go into these deals, because I think you have to have at least $250,000 worth of capital previously to be included into these high risk, right?
Yeah, generally they're not raising money from retail investors. It's hedge funds, it's institutional investors. If you're going to do a SPAC, it's going to be $1 billion acquisition. Like you're not creating a SPAC really for less than that. So I think for a lot of the Silicon Valley behemoths who are looking to go public, you know, that's going to be a good avenue. And a lot of them are led by some of the smartest, you know, investors out there. Like, you know, you know, everyone really has their own SPAC now. And, you know, if Bill Ackman tells you, come in on my SPAC, you know, you're going to go in on the SPAC because he's got, you know, a pretty good track record in the industry.
All right. And so with that process, it's like a, you'd call the leader of that is the venture capitalist, right? Am I right there? I don't understand the vocabulary that well. So I'm kind of just bouncing it off of you.
Yeah. Venture capital is just more of like a generic title. It's typically, companies that have raised either their own fund or they're partnering with other institutional investors. Typically, they invest in private companies that they feel will exit sooner than later, vis-a-vis a acquisition or an IPO or some sort of liquidity event.
Yeah, and so for people who want to, the audience that are wanting to get into the business of esports, and there are a number of people. I had a consultation or a meeting with someone yesterday who is trying to decide whether they should start their own company or go work for a bigger company in the established esports space. Their resume, their experience level would equate them to more on the corporate side than just like a startup or something like that. I mean, they could always start up their own startup, but working for a startup wouldn't necessarily make sense for what they've accomplished in their lives and their professional career. And so when someone is entering the industry and wanting to start a business, talk a little bit about the Canadian market and the opportunities there versus what's different here in the US. And is there a process that international folks have to do to be able to start a business in Canada versus start a person in Canada starting their own business in Canada?
Yeah. So, in general, you got to figure out, do you like the pros and cons of working for a bigger company? And the pros are, more stability in your employment, maybe more benefits like dental and health and stock options, and things like that. The cons are, maybe you don't work your own hours. You don't have the same flexibility. You don't have the same direction. And then if you're entrepreneurial and, then maybe the startup is better for you. It's definitely harder in the beginning, but probably more upside in the end if you're successful. So you got to decide what fits your personality. In terms of opening up your own corporation, both are extremely easy. And there's like so many websites you could do it. Like I could open up a corporation by the time you ask me your next question in either country. Like it's that, mm-hmm. it's that easy. You don't need to get a lawyer anymore. In Canada, there's sites like Owner. In the US, like I've seen a whole bunch of startups that are doing the exact same thing where you can incorporate, open up a bank account, even organize your cap table. You could do all that without ever talking to a lawyer. And you could do it like all online in a pretty easy portal to operate.
What about the process in Canada are there incentives or grants for doing gaming and esports companies?
Not necessarily. We do have a lot of grants that can apply to esports and gaming. Things like, if you're going to be solving complex technological problems, there are science and research grants available. Right now during COVID, we've got a whole menu of benefits, whether it's subsidies for your rent, subsidies for your employees, subsidies for your power, like it goes on. So a lot out there, but typically for small businesses, that science, the research and development is the most common, but there's definitely not anything for esports. If you are creating content that's going to be that a broadcaster would partner on, there's additional tax credits for things like that.
For the Motion Pictures Association in Canada, most likely, right?
Yeah, like if you wanted to do an esports show that was going to be broadcast on a major TV network, the government does offer a very generous amount of tax credits to create that production.
Right. Yeah, and that's something that in where I'm at in Texas is kind of hit or miss. There's definitely not the incentives necessarily, but Production costs here are not that high compared to like in California or other places. So it there's sort of an incentive to do esports production here in Texas. Now that we move into like the second segment of this this podcast, I want to talk to you specifically about Amica Esports and all of the content that you're creating for that brand. Going a little bit back though, and asking one last question about structure wise, what was the process when you first started the company? You had Amica Capital and you wanted to spin off into Amica Esports, a totally new brand, associated, not disassociated, but associated through you. What was that process like in starting that company, getting the right partners, getting the right employees, contractors involved to start establishing the startup?
Yeah, we went through a lot of different iterations in terms of the business model. Our original plan was to create an esports fund, you know, that investors can have in their what we call an RSP or your 401k, you know, or Roth IRA. So that was the idea, but it didn't make sense for a lot of reasons. And then we sort of pivoted to, you know, let's create a corporation. Let's raise a bit of capital. We raised not much, like maybe about $1 million to date. Originally, we thought we were going to invest in companies, and then we realized that was a terrible idea, and that it was much better to actually acquire the companies to really create that whole ecosystem. So after our first two investments, we moved away from that, and then we made I think 5 acquisitions. And then kind of the stage after was more now that there's a good term, it's called like acqui-hire, you know. So we have this amazing team that's composed of all of our acquisitions. So now we have that talent pool to go out and start these initiatives that we don't need to acquire anymore. So we launched our own esports incubator. We launched our own championship tournament series, you know, our gaming academy. So all these things were now possible now that we've created that management team. That were really all founders and entrepreneurs, all now under one company.
Yeah, that's that approach is something that I think is in a class of its own. I don't hear about it too much. The acqui-hire is something that you see in big corporations, but from the guys like yourself who are very entrepreneurial, you don't see it as much in the space. Speaking of which, what is your role at Amica Esports and how are you still contributing to it?
Yeah, sure. And by the way, the acqui-hire, like, you know, why did Apple buy Beats? Like,
yeah.
you don't think they can make a headphone? But no, you know, to get Jimmy and to get Dr. Dre involved, that's what you're buying. Like, otherwise, like, you think Apple couldn't make a Beat headphone, like, you know? So we see that a lot. You know, you acquire companies because it's a good team. So my role at Amica, yeah, it's, you know, I'm the CEO, so I'm responsible for the vision. I take all the shit from all of our partners and make sure that our team is taken care of and protected, and they're doing their job. So, you know, that's sort of my job right now as CEO, and it's going to change as the company matures and things change.
Yeah, and if you don't mind, what was the 3 different verticals that you guys are pursuing?
Yeah, so luckily I created the acronym META so that I can remember it, because otherwise I wouldn't. So right. I always go through it. So yeah, we're in media. We are in I can't remember the E.
Esports. Probably.
Teams and arenas. Yeah.
M-E-N-T, teams and arenas. And one thing from those 3 things that you mentioned previously, the one thing that rang sparked my interest in asking you a question about tournaments. You mentioned tournaments. And so it's not a platform per se, right? You use external third-party platforms, right?
Yeah, exactly. We do like 200 to 300, you know, live events a year. They're all online right now. So typically, you know, we'll use smash.gg for, you know, registration and, you know, and marketing. And then depending on the game, we'll use, you know, different platforms to run it. So yeah, we're not married to one platform. We really just, depending on the tournament and the need, we'll select our tools and run the best tournament.
And with that being said, what are some of the challenges that you've faced thus far in being a tournament organizer slash admin operator for those tournaments?
I would say the biggest challenge with online tournaments is that they can't and don't make money. You can't charge for online. So let's back up. I have a gaming arena. So when you come mm-hmm. to Waves Gaming in Toronto, we're giving you a professional gaming experience, stage, casters, you know, audience. Like, it's exciting. It's an experience. You're going to pay money to come and feel like a pro for a few hours in a tournament online. And I don't have any competition really. Like, a couple of them went out of business. So I'm a premium experience here. As soon as I go online, I'm competing with hundreds, if not thousands, of tournament organizers. Like, how many Warzone tournaments are there? Honestly, yeah, I could find you thousands. Like
thousands, yeah.
Thousands of tournaments. So what differentiates me from the others? The only thing that that differentiates a lot of them is the prize pool. And like, I don't want to be the guy who gives the most for a, you know, Warzone free roll prize pool, because it doesn't do anything. It doesn't build a community. You just get the good players come in, they win the money, they're out of here. So it's figuring out, how do you create an online strategy where you are building your community, but also you have some sort of economics that makes sense? That took a lot of time to figure out. And like, we did really bad when COVID hit because we just couldn't figure that out. And then eventually we finally got our shit together. And now we're able to sort of understand the economics of online tournaments better. And that's what we're doing now.
I see. And you mentioned that you can't charge for these online tournaments. Is that because of the age of the players?
No, it's just that's the market. Like, there's so many
saturated
re-entry Warzone tournaments. Why is someone going to pay? Right. Like,
right.
So that's the market. The market was set at free. And the other thing is, so, you know, your tournaments are going to be really, you know, your revenue is sponsorship generated. Mm. So you need as many people in that event as possible. Like, you need the eyeballs. And if a $5 right. or $10 entry fee is going to stop that, then it's not worth it. You got to go free.
Yeah, this is a really challenging issue, because I know a lot of companies that are trying to get into esports from the non-endemic standpoint that see tournaments as the opportunity to reach a larger number of people. But at the same point in time, if the tournament organizers and admins aren't able to monetize that directly, because, you know, the consumer is used to a free roll opportunity, which I love that you use that vocabulary, because that comes from like traditional poker,
casinos,
right? And especially since it's in the meta right now, with all the Twitch streamers being controversial about their partnerships with Stake or Rubet or whatnot, and issues in that way. But neither here nor there. My interest is kind of like, with that being said, are these some of the topics and conversations that you have on Esports Unfiltered, or what can an audience kind of get from that podcast?
Yeah, I started the show. It's like kind of funny. I'm a huge fan of Esports Talk with Jay Lucky. Like, yeah. He is my absolute favorite guy. I love him. I love the show. But I always kind of felt like he, and that's the MO of the show, like, he kind of shows you both sides and like doesn't really take a position. And I saw a lot of other content creators, a lot of news was just like very, you know, vanilla in the sense that they're not taking a position and a stand. And I kind of wanted to see some esports content with that conviction. And so mm-hmm. Esports Unfiltered 1 was to the point where like, here's the issue and this is what I think. And I don't really give a shit what you think about it one way or another. I'm going to give you my opinion. Obviously, I'm going to explain the broader scope. But the other thing was to create a show that's not like gamey. It's not about like who tweeted what about what. Like, it's about issues that if you don't know about esports, it's relevant. So should mm-hmm. esports be at the Olympics? What about drug use, you know, Adderall abuse in gaming? Mm-hmm. We've talked about, you know, esports and retail partnerships. So we try to go at issues that aren't relevant to a particular game and just have a bit of a broader appeal.
It's sort of an approach to talking about the more controversial subjects in the professional side of esports and just esports in general. And you mentioned Jake Lucky of the Esports Talk Show. His show is definitely about gossip. It is like more Keemstar, you know, drama alert more adjacent to that than I think it is like a Danny Martin's show for Exposure, which is more or less you're somewhere in between there and Jake Lucky. You know, you have your super buttoned up corporate-y parent, you know, focused conversations to where you're talking about like serious business issues and serious cultural issues that are in the esports space. And that's really why I enjoyed listening to your show previously. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show. And so the other thing that other than the tournaments that you're doing, you have a team. And so what made you decide to go down the team route when you probably know this as well as most of the audience that teams are generally loss leaders when it comes to the esports space.
You can replace the word generally with almost always losers in terms of like an ROI. I've always hated teams. I've always shat on franchises. I've always said the economics suck, and they do. So why do we have a team? Couple reasons. One is, in order to really activate a brand, I think you need to hit them on all four corners. And we call sponsorships, you know, sort of multi-channel. I don't know if people are going to check out your brand because they're following the team or our content or coming to our arenas or another tournaments. So I'm going to put our brand in all those channels. So I needed that channel for the team. So that's one. And I think brands really love our team. It's like an awesome activation point. And you have to be really strategic. Like, we signed a Rainbow Six roster that qualified for the Six Invitational, which is the World Series of Rainbow Six. Like, and it was a team that everyone counted out. and we ended up finishing, you know, top 12 in the world, taking home 75 grand, you know, US prize pool. So, and beating the world champions actually in the group stage. Can we do this every time with every roster? No. Like, you know, we got lucky as an org. These players are incredibly talented. So I wouldn't say they got lucky. They earned it and they're awesome. But you have to be extremely careful with what you're in. And like, there's opportunities now that I'm passing on just because like I just don't have the capital. And to some degree, there's a little bit of gambling in it. Like, you know, if you hit it right and it makes sense, like look at a team like OG. Like, you know, that's an example of just, it's not a massive org. They didn't raise a shitload of capital, but they've taken two TIs back to back. They're probably the most winningest team in esports history, maybe. I crunched the numbers. Well, but
that, and they're super innovative. They do, you know, sort of unconventional things. Like, I think they were the first team to ever have an NFT, right? They were the first team to launch a full-fledged, you know, full category of NFTs.
Yeah, no,
around
exactly.
Those championships.
Yeah, and I think what's nice about sort of the non-franchised esports is, to some degree, you can't buy your way to victory. You have to earn it. You have to scout. You have to develop. And I'm excited about that. And I think some of the franchise leagues, maybe there's some of that, but to some degree, if you don't have a big pocketbook, you know, you don't have a seat at the table.
Right. Well, I mean, that's another conversation I was having during another consultation/meeting was that the traditional sports people are entering the space. You're Mark Cuban's, you're Jerry Jones, that's literally the two that always come to my mind.
Bob Kraft, yeah.
Right, yeah, and the Patriots and stuff like that. And their approach is sort of trying to buy wins. In a way, just by having the bigger brands and a little bit of capital. But with you, that being said, for you, what games are your teams currently competing in?
At the pro level right now, yeah, only Rainbow Six. We had a pro Rocket League team, but the roster disbanded and we're still looking to get back in. And then I would say, with women's esports, we're probably going to be signing three rosters in Rocket League, Rainbow Six, and Valorant. So again, you know, we're going to be playing in non-franchise leagues. I think that's where it's at. And I think also team-based makes a lot more sense than, you know, the individual, whether it's Battle Royale or FGC. The economics of those sports are a little bit harder.
And then I guess that leads into my question about the individuals. So how do you decide who you're going to sign as players for your teams?
Yeah, so I use a term called underwriting a team or a player. So mm-hmm. what we'll do is we'll look at the opportunity. And then we look at in the next six, again, contracts are short. They're typically 6 months or a year. So we'll say in the next 6 months, what are the tournaments they're going to compete in? What's the total prize pool? What's the likely position of this player? So we'll underwrite with all the analytics, like we'll put in all the data, all the costs, our current sponsorship growth, and then we'll make a financial decision. Does this roster make sense? And my guys, and I've got great, you know, general managers and scouts. They've come to me so many times with Valorant rosters, and like I plug in those numbers, and I keep saying the economics don't make any sense, and that's why we keep passing. And instead, we're in Rocket League, where it was great bang for a buck, and Rainbow Six also. Like I'm so happy we're in that league, and I love working with Ubisoft and Face It. So, that's personally how I do. Obviously, there's other factors, you know, personality and social reach and how they fit into the culture of your team. But first and foremost, I look at the P&L and say, does this make financial sense for us?
On the competition side?
For competitive players.
For competitive players, right. And so are you kind of, in some ways, since the competitive side isn't really paying the bills, do you have to make a sacrifice to decision to hire someone who's maybe more popular on a Twitter or a Twitch or something like that, YouTuber?
Yes and no. Like, you know, obviously content teams are really big and people are very big on that. And that's something we would do, but I believe winning is everything. So that's what I want to do. I really respect TSM's philosophy. It's not really about the content. It's not really about selling merch and hoodies. It's about winning. And like, I admire that. Mm-hmm. That's the competitiveness in me wants to win. And when you win, it brings sponsors. And we did a great job with Rainbow Six. We got a lot of new sponsors now because of that. And I'm looking to leagues where in esports, where we can field the team that's going to be competitive and is going to win.
When you go to sponsors and advertisers and talk about win-loss ratios, what are they, what's the feedback? What are they, how do they even analyze a win? What is it that they're, what does a win mean to them?
Yeah, so that is, it is secondary to the sponsors, generally speaking. They want to know about your socials. They want to know about your engagement, but they want to know, how are you going to activate our brand? And so really it comes down to, you have to be creative and you have to come up with something unique. Like just putting a logo on your social banner or just putting a logo watermark on a stream is boring, it's lazy, and you're a dime a dozen. So, you know, when an energy maker like Guru, for example, came to us, it was like, what are you guys about? We're about, you know, extreme sports, outdoor activity, health and wellness. Awesome. So what we did is we created the Guru Good Energy Challenge, where we challenge gamers to get out there, take a video of your of you doing some sort of outdoor activity and tag it. And like, let's create a campaign around that. And so that's what we did for them. And that's how we work with sponsors, is doing like that. Is the team going to win? Very, very secondary to them. But I think that's what grows the fan base. So think of it like a circle. You win, more people follow you, more people follow you, more brands want to follow you, more brands start sponsoring you, you sign more players and better teams. And it's a nice upward spiral from there.
So I guess what I was thinking of right there, as you were talking about brand activation and whatnot, when they are talking about wins, wins mean that you're on the stage, you're on camera longer. You know, you win your matches, you go to the championship. Their logos are there associated with winning, right? So I guess in that component, how do you guys, monetize jerseys? And if, do you also do rebroadcasts of the tournaments onto your own channels?
Yeah, a win is ROI, like a return on investment. You know, so if a brand is not getting, and if they don't feel they're getting an ROI, then I failed, and I do not expect them to come back. So sometimes it's measurable. You know, like for example, how many people click through the link. You know, we can track sales, we can track signups, things like that. So that will be a win for them if we can deliver on that ROI there. And then there's kind of that you know, building the brand within the industry, brand authenticity, brand equity, things like that, which to some degree is less measurable, although we can measure some of it with impressions and things like that. So we want to make sure we come to them and say, we're going to do both. We're going to build your brand equity in esports, and we want to deliver an ROI. And if we can do that, that's a win. If the team sucks, I don't think the brand, the sponsor really cares if we hit on those things. If we didn't hit on those things and our team sucks, well, then like what's the reason for them to stick around?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we move into the third segment of this podcast, I want to ask you a question about what's most exciting to you. What do you see in the esports industry that's really cutting edge or bleeding edge?
Man, that's actually it's a good question, and I got to think about it. What excites me? Maybe collegiate esports, I would say. I think.
Right.
I love that high schools, you know, that the leagues for high schools are maturing. I love that the collegiate scene, whether it's with CSL or NACE, that's all coming together. So I really like that aspect of it. One thing that we're involved in is, you know, we help universities build, you know, develop academic curriculum for esports as an area to study. So just like you would study sports management, now you can study esports management. So I love that there's a whole bunch of esports programs across North America at colleges and universities for students. I think that's going to prepare them for a career in this industry, which is getting bigger. And what else? I mean, like the new games. This industry keeps you on your toes. You know, everything changes. You know, one day you're a hero, and another day, like you know, today, Activision Blizzard got killed. You know, like the lawsuit from the state of California came out about major sexual harassment and this kind of frat culture. So how's the industry going to respond? What are we going to do about it? What's that company going to do about it? What are the teams? How do we respond and make a better community? Like, as much as I love saying how great esports and gaming is, there's some messed up issues that need to be dealt with. The fact that a lot of women don't feel safe, you know, being on camera, and the harassment, and I've experienced it myself, like not against me, but I've been in a game when people are dropping N-bombs and people are making homophobic slurs, and it's prevalent. Like, so that's like the category of exciting me is cleaning up the industry. Sorry, now you got to unpack that.
Well, I mean, that's the popular conversation when it comes to offline conventions and online conversations. Those are the most popular conversations. Collegiate is interesting, but there's definitely a lot of gatekeepers when it comes to what can and cannot happen in the esports space, and like the controversy between whether universities will align with athletics and allow them to be competitive, or align with student life and make them kind of it makes it hard for them to compete as a club. So the university space is something that I'm interested in, but also kind of still feel like I need to create this distance between it, because I find myself wanting to be more aligned with the professional side and the commercial side with, you know, the improvement of land centers and whatnot. But in the education space at large, including collegiate and also high school and whatnot, I'm seeing a lot of great innovations because the government, at least in the US, is stepping in and providing some funding to establish those programs. So for consultants and whatnot that are in the space and suppliers, there's a growing opportunity in creating those programs like you've created, and also supplying the hardware and the training curriculum for the teachers. And so in your market, Canada, is that also happening, where the school boards and the government are stepping in to kind of help foster these programs, at least the high school level, because that's where it's most interesting.
to me. Let's talk. I just want to comment on the varsity thing for a second. I can say with 100% certainty that esports will be varsity programs. And it's simple math. Like, you know, what are some of the tier two and tier three varsity sports? Like softball. Okay. Right. Softball is a varsity sport. Water polo, field hockey.
So let me ask you this. Okay. Why is there such a reluctance for the administration at universities to validate, that's one word,
yeah,
or approve this merger into the athletics departments?
Well, just in general, they move slower. I think
bureaucracy.
There's some issues as well because no one owns field hockey. No one owns volleyball. No one owns softball. But people own Overwatch and people own Smash. So it's a little bit different when you are a little bit reliant on a for-profit corporation to run your program. And you can, what you can and can't do is clearly at their discretion. So if you're going to make a massive investment in Overwatch and then, you know, Blizzard can just say, nah, we're done, we're closing the game, whatever it is. So there's risk there. There's risk for teams. There's risk for schools. But at the end of the day, it's going to be dollars and cents. I just don't see advertisers coming into softball. I'm just going to shit on softball as the example. But really, it can be replaced with so many other traditional sports with incremental or even dying player bases. So
water polo.
Water polo, volleyball, like, you know, and you're going to get all these comments now from people who play these sports that are going to hate me and hate you. But again, I'm just purely talking like growth of the sport. And I am saying it from an ignorant place. I haven't researched the growth of tier two and tier three.
I think sports. The negative pushback is from intelligent people is going to be, well, we're validated by the Olympic Committee. You are not.
Oh, that is the biggest horseshit ever. The Olympics means absolutely nothing. The Olympics come in, they bankrupt cities. They're the most corrupt entity. There's drug abuse. Like doping all the time.
Yeah.
People are banned. No one's interested. And people say, should esports be at the Olympics? Absolutely not. Why would we put esports at a world event that is dying, that lacks so much competitive integrity? So I don't, please give me that argument that the Olympics is what decides what's a sport or not. You know, it's total horseshit.
I love your perspective. I love your opinion because I think a lot of people are afraid to state how they feel about this space. And for whatever reason, because they want to retain their integrity in traditional sports because they either got laid off from an opportunity and saw esports as another career transitioning opportunity because they can't get validated in their own space. There's just so many issues in the space. And so when we talk about collegiate, there's a lot of just, you know, tenured staff and faculty that are preventing the growth of esports, at least in that space. And being, you know, creating red tape that doesn't need to be there, in my opinion. That's my opinion. Yeah.
I would add that anyone who's an ambassador for this industry, we have to change the perception that gamers are these fat, lazy, Red Bull drinking, Dorito eating sloths, and change the conversation that professional esports athletes are athletes. They take tremendous amount of care with their body. They're tremendously focused on health and wellness, both mental and physical. And they take it very seriously. Like, this is their career. So I think that's like this perception of, the athlete is going out there and training all day and, you know, being physical and whatnot. And the esports athlete is just, you know, sitting there. And I get that there's some truth to that. Like, you know, snowboarders or like bobsledders. Yeah. In a way, maybe they're risking their lives competing or there's serious injury on the line. And I'm not going to take anything away from that. But we have to change the conversation for gamers around health and wellness to really appreciate the athleticism there.
Right. And so, you know, this goes into the more general public access, and we'll wrap this up here soon, is the aspect of esports being more recreational for anyone to participate in at any point in time. And you mentioned the developers own the football is something that people say are like the developer own the game. Do you see an open source game emerging in the categories of FPS, MOBA, TCG, just like an open source game where nobody necessarily owns the game?
I don't know. It's no, I don't really think so. There's just billions and billions of dollars on the line. Like, I just don't
see IP.
Yeah. I just don't see, like, you know, even if it was like a Jeff Bezos, who's already retired from Amazon, clearly from what he said after his space launch, does not give a shit about his, employees and customers. He's made his money. He has big ambitions. I just don't think that's a problem that billionaires want to solve. And there's just so much to keep that game up to date. And there's no way a nonprofit sort of coalition or consortium of could pull something like that off.
Completely understandable. I want to say thank you for coming on the show. Again, Ben Pfefferman of Amica Esports. For the audience, I'd like to give you the opportunity to let people know how to contact you and get connected with Amica as well.
Yeah, sure. Again, thanks so much for having me on. Great conversation. The best way, Twitter, 5kpfeff, or Instagram, and LinkedIn, Ben Pfefferman. You can also check out amukaesports.com, where we have some of the stuff that we're doing.
Awesome. Once again, Ben Pfefferman, CEO of Amica Esports. This has been the Esports Business Network podcast. Thank you for listening.
Hey, y'all, it's Trent Knox, founder and CEO of Esports Business Network. I want to say thank you for listening to this podcast. If you're finding value in the podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you share the podcast to your network and write a positive review on your preferred podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, feel free to make a contribution to our working capital accounts on Cash App or PayPal. Our username is ESPORTSBIZNET. That's Esports BizNet on both platforms. As always, we'd love for you to join our community and platform at https://www.ebn.gg. You can take advantage of a free subscription to our bronze membership by following the directions on the homepage. Part of the bronze membership is access to our Discord server and private membership channels. The conversation only evolves with participation from esports entrepreneurs like yourself. We need to hear about your esports business to understand how we can move the industry forward as a community. You can also join the community by joining the Facebook and LinkedIn groups. An additional goal of EBN is to move the conversation forward on your preferred social media platform. So as a last note, don't forget to follow us on social media for current events, news, and other esports related topics. Follow and subscribe to Esports Business Network on social media. Looking forward to networking with you very soon.